welcome to the Small Caps Podcast, where we discuss news and information related to ASX-listed companies and financial markets, keeping investors informed. Note that the content in this podcast is not financial or investment advice, and be sure to head over to smallcaps.com.au to get the latest market news. Now, without further delay, here's today's podcast.
Welcome back to Small Caps. My name is Kerry Stevenson. Today, we're going to be talking all things economy with somebody I've known for a while. His name is John Adams. He is an economist and a political commentator, because you're gonna love politics during this time of the COVID. John, welcome to the program. Great to see you. We're going to talk property as well, and I'm seeing all those cranes behind you, but we'll get onto that in a little while. John, welcome to the program. I really want to unpack quite a few things today. We'll try and do this within 30, 40 minutes. We're going to talk about gold. We're going to talk about the economy, but let's start with back in March and April of this year, when there was the beginning of the pandemic and the world was beginning to shut down. A lot of people at that time were saying, we're going to have a V-shaped recovery and all's going to be right with the world. And I'm sitting here in Sydney, Australia, and it's very different in Victoria. We're both in New South Wales. It feels to me like people are saying, it's the old Australian adage, she'll be right, mate. What are your thoughts?
Well, thank you for having me on the show, Kerry. I'll probably make a couple of observations. I mean, in reality, we should have had a V-shaped recovery because, I wrote an essay for my website back in April, but I wrote it basically in mid-March. And by mid-March, it was clear to me that COVID-19 was nowhere near as lethal as what we were initially led to believe. I mean, you had Imperial College from London saying that if unmitigated, 40 million people worldwide would die. You had the Doherty Institute telling the Morrison government that 150,000 Australians would die if you don't do anything. And you know, when you started to look at how they were recording the deaths, but also the level of asymptomatic cases, so anywhere between 50 to 70% of people who have COVID-19 have no symptoms, therefore they were never in the case count. And so COVID-19 is more pervasive throughout the community than what the official numbers suggest. We should have lifted the lockdown in March. So I'm happy. So at the beginning, when you don't know what's really going on, when you're getting conflicting information, when you're seeing some scary scenes from places like Wuhan or from Lombardy in Italy, if you want to take some drastic action because you just don't know what you're dealing with, I can understand that. But the data was pretty clear in mid-March that it was serious, but it wasn't like Ebola. It wasn't going to basically ruin the entire population. So had we unlocked back in, say, early April, I think we would have had a V-shaped recovery. The fact that we're now in September and we're still in lockdown, and obviously Victoria is still in stage four lockdown in terms of Melbourne, and that stage four lockdown is probably going to continue going into October. To my mind, it's been an absolute economic catastrophe. Now, in terms of your viewers, just so that they know, I mean, I've been warning about this economic Armageddon from 2016, writing for the Daily Telegraph in Sydney, to writing for news.com in 2017-18, and then doing a whole host of YouTube commentary and some more articles on my website in 2018 and 19. So we have the biggest debt bubble in Australian history in terms of household debt. We have the biggest debt bubble in world history in terms of global debt. There is no case study that we can point to show that we're going to get out of this, without some sort of economic catastrophe. And the question is, what sort of catastrophe are we headed towards? Is it some sort of deflationary depression? Is it stagflation, hyperinflation? They're the sort of broad range of possibilities that we can potentially go through. So I knew that we were going to have an economic crisis at some point, and that's why I've been preparing myself. And as we get into the gold conversation, I've been buying gold and silver for 4 years. I now work as chief economist for As Good As Gold Australia, which is South Australia's largest bullion dealership. So I've been in the industry for a couple of years, and helping Australians wake up to the level of risk that is really out there. So the economic situation in 2020. So basically what I'm trying to say is there is a context, and the context was that the Australian economy and the world economy was in pretty bad shape. in terms of all of this debt going around and the level of systemic risk in terms of before COVID-19. And what COVID-19 really did was it brought the crisis forward and it accelerated the process. And for those who were ready, I mean, so for me, in 6 months, hand on heart, I can say that I've never gone to sleep once worried about money because I took a whole host of precautions, no debt, a lot of savings, a lot of bullion, quite a few reserves. And that was the objective I wanted to have in terms of protecting my own family. But there's a whole bunch of Australians who were not prepared, and COVID-19 has just sort of like hit them like by a 2x4. And obviously the government has tried to paper over some of these economic problems with all this unprecedented stimulus. Now, the stimulus is going to cause a whole host of problems going forward. But also I would say that, you know, we're recording on Wednesday, next Monday, JobKeeper and JobSeeker are supposed to start being cut back. And I think you're going to start to see more businesses fold. We're going to start to see the unemployment rate go up. And you're going to start to see more economic pain from October through to Christmas. And you know, the real economic horror, I think, is going to be sort of coming in the next few months.
John, let's just talk about that a little bit. Let's talk about the government stimulus. Clearly, that has papered over the cracks and, you know, the emperor has no clothes. But it sounds to me like the government is just going to throw, you know, it's like a Mario Draghi. We'll do whatever it takes to ensure Australia does not go into a recession. I mean, this is the first time we've been under good times for almost 30 years. So a lot of people won't have ever gone through a recession and they don't understand that there are some challenges ahead. But do you think the government is just going to say, it's all going to be okay. We'll give you a base income so you can cover it. It's kind of, we'll go into universal basic income in a minute, but do you think they're saying that they're going to pull it back, but do you think they will?
No. So probably a couple of points. I mean, I've been having some conversations over the last couple of weeks with some political scientists, and I've been talking to federal members of parliament. And for the benefit of your viewers, I used to work in federal parliament as an economic advisor, so I still have some pretty good political contacts where I can call people up and chew the fat on some stuff. So it's clear to me that if we're going to think about economics in the next 12 months, politics is driving the economic strategy. So here's where some of the economists are making mistakes. Some of the economists are looking at the economy and basically saying, well, what's government going to do based on the economic facts? That's not what's really happening. I mean, basically, the Prime Minister is focused on, I think he's focused on two things. One is he wants to win the next election. The next election is going to be at the end of 2021 at some point. The view obviously is that when you've got the biggest debt bubble in the history of the country, if you let that debt bubble go, if you have a huge depression, if you see unemployment at 25%, if you see huge amounts of people default on their mortgages, if you see the banks come to their knees, the consensus is you cannot win a federal election that way. So part of the reason for the stimulus was not really about COVID-19, it was about political survival. So that's point one. But point two is, it was also to protect the financial cartel that runs Australia. So real political power in Australia is the RBA, APRA, and the commercial banks. Mm-hmm. And so even though this stimulus was targeted at households, the reason why they had to give households all this money was to ensure that they didn't default on the debt. Because if they started to default on the, you know, the mortgages, the personal loans, the car finance, et cetera, well, who's the counterparty that's going to take the hit? It's the banks. Mm-hmm. And if the banks fall, well, I mean, yes, that makes the economic crisis worse, but who has benefited from all this build up and accumulation of debt over the last 20 years? It's been the banking sector. And so I do think that there is a unspoken consensus between the coalition and the ALP that they were going to do whatever they need to do to protect the vested interests that have, you know, that have accumulated significant amounts of wealth with the debt bubble that we've built up over the last 20, 30 years.
So, John, what you've just told me, it's not about the economy, it's about political power.
Absolutely. The thing is, like, all of this comes down to, well, a lot of it is political power, but it's also about financial power. And there's a whole host of vested interests that have become wealthy through all this, in terms of the expansion of household debt. And if you let the debt bubble collapse, that will basically bring these financial elites to their knees, and obviously they don't want that to happen. So today's Wednesday. Yesterday, the Deputy Governor Guy Debelle from the RBA, he gave a speech, and he said that it was appropriate for the government to use its strong balance sheet to provide assistance to the household sector. Now, what is he really saying? He's saying it's appropriate for the government to bankrupt my kids in order to bail out the banks. I mean, because that's exactly what's happened. I mean, I've got a six-year-old and my youngest one's 1.5. I mean, their financial economic future in Australia has been ruined in order to basically save a financial cartel that would have been destroyed had the debt bubble imploded during the pandemic.
John, why do you say that your children's future is ruined? I mean, that's a very strong word. Do you see, because I'm looking at it and I'm saying, and I don't call it money. You and I will talk about gold and silver in a minute because I consider that money. So while governments around the world can continue to print currency ad infinitum, call it funny money, prop it all up, all you've got to do is go buy a house or go buy some real assets, you'll be fine because the price will go up because they just keep pushing liquidity into the system. I don't see that ending anytime soon. Do you?
Well, yes. So you're asking me a couple of questions. So the first one is, why are my children's future ruined? Now, so when you look at, for example, government debt, the federal government's going to have debt of over $1 trillion. Some of these state governments, like Queensland's, projected to have $109 billion worth of debt. Victoria's heavily in debt, so is Western Australia. Do you think that there is any appetite to actually pay back this debt?
None.
Now, one of the problems, I'm writing an article about this for my website, and this is very controversial to say, the biggest impediment is democracy. And the thing is that, so when I talk to politicians, now, back in the 18th and 19th century, you had Americans and you had some UK scholars who were anti-democratic because they said that with a democracy, once people can figure out they can get something for nothing from government, they're going to vote in politicians who are going to promise them the world, and they're never going to allow those promises or that free stuff to be ever taken away. Now, when I talk to members of federal parliament about running austerity in terms of raising interest rates, shrinking household debt, slashing government spending, and actually running a balanced budget to actually get this debt under control, I consistently being told, if we try that, we can't win an election. So the politicians, in their mind, they feel stuck that they can't do anything other than continue in terms of perpetuating the debt bubble. And any country that has huge amounts of either private sector debt or public sector debt, it's not going to be a flourishing economy. And so we're stuck with all this debt. The politicians tell me that we can't reverse course because the public won't wear it. And so when I think about, so my oldest is 6 years old, in 12 years she'll be an adult. What sort of economy will we have? It's not going to be a particularly healthy economy, when she turns 18. What was the second part of the question that you asked me?
I've completely forgotten myself now. I think what I'm getting at now, John, is while the governments keep printing all this money, while it keeps going, it doesn't matter, does it? We talk about your children's future being, people can just go and buy houses because all this money, all this liquidity is going into the market, prices go up. The wealth effect, I guess you could call it.
Yes. I'm glad you asked that question, because the second part of your question is, can't we just go buy real assets and we'll be fine when we have runaway inflation? Now, when I read about runaway inflation, when I read about hyperinflation, like in Germany in 1923, there are some people who are smart enough to know who know what to do economically, who can survive, who can prosper, who can actually make a lot of money out of hyperinflation. But the overwhelming majority of a population that goes through a hyperinflation episode, they do not benefit from that. I mean, it ruins people. And so, you know, I mean, when you look at how many Australians actually own gold and silver, maybe 2%, maybe 3%. I mean, having been in the industry for the last couple of years, I've seen a whole bunch of new entrants into the market who have bought gold and silver and to add it to their portfolio, some in small amounts, some in very significant amounts, but there is still, I would say, at least 90% of the Australian population that have no exposure to gold and silver. So the question then becomes is, if we have stagflation at the moment, and I think the data shows that if it results in potential hyperinflation, and that will...
John, I'm just going to interrupt you briefly there because I just want to unpack it for our listeners out there. Stagflation, what is stagflation? No wage growth, higher prices, would that be the... shortened up.
So hyperinflation is in terms of stagflation, so it's when you have low economic growth, high unemployment, and you have rising prices. And the reason why, you know, that according to the Keynesian textbook shouldn't happen is that, so if you have high unemployment because you have a lack of aggregate demand, prices should be falling according to the Keynesian model. So in the 1970s, when prices were rising at the same time that unemployment was high, that basically smashed the Phillips curve whole mantra. And basically the Keynesian economists were scratching their heads and saying, well, that basically shouldn't happen.
Right. And so let's unpack that. Do you see Australia right now, where we are at the moment, because there is a little bit of talk about rising prices, rising unemployment. Are we in deflation, stagflation, hyperinflation? Where are we, John? Where are we? Inflation.
Sure. Okay. So I think when we look at this, we need to be very clear about what is deflation in terms of what is deflation, what is inflation. So, you know, in the pre-Keynesian era, you know, inflation, deflation was all about the money supply, and so it's clear to me that during this pandemic, the money supply has grown. And if you look at, for example, the RBA's statistics on broad money, which is the broadest definition of money, it's growing at the fastest rate, annualized rate, since 2009. So we have seen a huge amount of money printing that has been injected into the economy. Obviously, that's why we have huge money, huge growth in the money supply. And obviously, at the same time, we're seeing unemployment go up. Now, it is true that, a couple of points to unpack there. The first one is that the government will argue that we in the second quarter we had deflation because they had printed a negative CPI number. Now, why did we have a negative CPI number in the second quarter? It's because childcare was basically, they basically put childcare costs at zero because childcare was made free. And that was never a permanent decision. So they purposely distorted the CPI purely for propaganda purposes by including one-off policy measures, which were always going to be reversed. So childcare was the biggest factor. The other thing you had was in terms of primary school, there was some costs there that were basically made free. They included that. And then you obviously had the price of oil. And the price of oil, I mean, yeah, so during that quarter, it actually hit, you know, like, I think negative $40 a barrel. So you had some huge one-off factors that led to this negative number. But if you talk to the average Aussie and saying, well, are things getting more expensive or more expensive or less expensive? I think they will say more expensive. So I, even though, you know, the government is saying we have deflation, if you look at the money supply versus this CPI number, the money supply is growing at a huge rapid rate. And that does take time. When you print money, it does take time to flow through to prices. So we have to be patient about seeing that inflation really showing up. Now, we can see that. So let me give you an example. In the last fortnight in Wollongong, so Wollongong is like the third largest city in New South Wales. there's a new commercial building which is only about 5 years old, which is being leased by the Australian Taxation Office. It sold and set a record for the city at $57 million. So, and people are scratching their heads thinking, how can a five-story commercial building in Wollongong sell for $57 million? Well, I mean, it is all the money that's sloshing around. And rising real estate prices or rising financial assets, I mean, that is part of the inflationary process. So the inflation could be in commodities, it can be in financial assets, it can be in real estate, it can be in ordinary goods and services. But, you know, even for example, a few days ago, I got an email from a follower who, and she's quite elderly. She said that she's finding it more expensive to go shop. So when you go shopping, obviously things are getting more expensive. So anyone who says that we've got low inflation or we have deflation, you know, and all these arguments are based on the ABS CPI number. And I think those arguments are completely fallacious. Now, when we get to unemployment, so we had the surprising news last week where the unemployment number by the ABS fell from 7.5% to 6.8%. And that was sort of a big surprise to say, well, in August, we produced 111,000 new jobs. Now, when you actually dig into this number, well, what you find is there were no new employees. So the 111,000 new jobs, they were mainly they were either sole traders partnerships or they were incorporated new bodies. What the ABS call, look, in terms of owner managers.
So, John, are you saying that those 111,000 jobs that everybody got excited about potentially could have been John Smith over here has lost his job with the big whatever company, and they've started a new business as a sole trader that's counted as somebody being employed?
Absolutely. So, Kerry, one of the things you have to understand is what is the definition of employment 1 hour a week? So, for example, if I had a white collar job and I lost my job because of COVID-19 and I went off and washed a car for someone and they paid me and it took me an hour to wash the car, that's a job.
Are you serious? Wow. Lies, yeah. Damn lies and statistics.
Of course. So a lot of people during this pandemic, I mean, they have been desperate because they need income to basically in order to survive. So a lot of them have come up with new ways to make money. It could be selling things. It could be doing home services. It could be whatever the case may be. All of these people who are just, working as sole traders, I mean, that's why the unemployment number is down, because people are doing something to generate at least 1 hour of work a week. But the most important thing is none of these are employees of existing businesses.
Okay, so John, I really want to get in very quickly to two things. One, you recently said modern monetary theory, and that is let's keep printing and it's everything's going to be okay. And correct me if I've got that wrong. You call that academic fraud. I just want you to let me know about why you say that.
Sure. So the one of the leading proponents of MMT is Professor Bill Mitchell from the University of Newcastle. So one of the concerns about MMT is it's going to lead to hyperinflation. And so from an economic point of view, hyperinflation is when inflation runs at 50% per month. Germany 23, Zimbabwe 2008, Venezuela today. Now, the MMT crowd says that MMT won't create hyperinflation because hyperinflation wasn't created by excessive money printing. It was because there was some money printing, but the big issue was that you had a significant contraction in terms of production. So, for example, Professor Bill Mitchell will argue that in Zimbabwe, agricultural production fell because when Mugabe took over, he took the productive farms from white farmers and gave them to black peasants. And then those people didn't know how to grow food. And that's why you had like a 60-70% fall in food production. That's why prices went hugely crazy. And then obviously in terms of Germany, in 1923, France and Belgium walked into West Germany in the Ruhr region, and they basically shut down the most industrious part of Germany And that's what MOT people will argue, that that's the reason why they had hyperinflation. Now, that is complete bogus. We have seen in other situations where you can see a significant reduction in production, in terms of economic production, but without the excessive money printing, you don't have the hyperinflation. So you may have some inflation because there's less goods going around, but it's not going to be at millions percent in terms of the inflation. And I should say, just in terms of Germany, the interesting thing is that when this industrial part of Germany actually got shut down, so they were printing huge amounts of money in between World War One and from the start of World War One all the way through to 1922. And then when this industrial part of Germany got shut down, they basically implemented their own version of JobKeeper, JobSeeker. So Berlin basically didn't do nothing about this invasion by France and Belgium. The factories got down, the businesses got bailed out, the workers got unemployment insurance, and all this money printing then, it led to hyperinflation. And really, MMT basically, give a very misleading and false explanation as to why hyperinflation happened in places like Zimbabwe and Germany, and they obviously are trying to perpetuate a myth that says that their theory will not lead to the catastrophe that we've seen in other places in human history.
So your view is we are going to have inflation coming up, if not hyperinflation.
Well, yes. So we have stagflation now. So we have elevated unemployment, and the RBA is expecting unemployment to go to 10% by Christmas. We have huge amounts of money printing. We are seeing some examples of inflation, coming up. So, putting aside the CPI number, you talk to the average Australian and they'll say the number one issue is the cost of living. And if it's true that we have either low inflation or deflation, cost of living should not be as acute, as what people say it is. So I think that inflationary pressure is going to intensify. And what that means for middle class Australians is if you've got compressed income at the same time prices are going up, you're going to be squeezed. And that's going to make living standards and economic life in 2021 a lot tougher than 2020 or 2019.
John, we don't have too much longer to go, but I really want to ask you three more questions. First question is, if we are going into this economic Armageddon, potentially, what do you think is the best way for Australians, and I always say this, to protect and grow their wealth? Given interest rates are very low and potentially going lower, do they just go get themselves into hideous amounts of debt and buy real assets to protect themselves because they're going to be going up and that's the wealth effect? What do they do, John?
Sure. So the first point I would make is we the economic Armageddon that I've been talking about. So I think that we are seeing it right now. So when I wrote about economic Armageddon in 2018, I had six scenarios. One of the scenarios it was stagflation, and I think that stagflation is going to get worse. So what people should do, they definitely should try to hold real assets because those real assets will hold its value. But the other thing is that there are still risks around the global financial system. So for example, if a globally systemically important bank was to declare bankruptcy, like a Deutsche Bank or a JP Morgan, we could go from stagflation very quickly into deflation, because ultimately deflation, a deflationary depression, like what Harry Dent is saying, what it means is global debt has to shrink. And the only way global debt has to shrink is basically people have to default, and you've got to get one of these big banks, these big mega banks, to make the go bust, like with Lehman Brothers in 2008. So I would still be against holding a lot of debt. Now, if we have stagflation, runaway inflation, hyperinflation, and you have debt, the debt's not going to be a big problem, assuming you have real assets. You'll be able to profit from that. But if we go from a situation where you've got stagflation, hyperinflation, and then you get someone going bankrupt, and then it leads to an implosion of this debt bubble, and we have deflation, a deflationary depression at that point, if you have debt, you're going to be wiped out. So my balance sheet is very clean. I have no debt. I have a lot of real assets. I have diverse sources of income. We're looking at growing food and stockpiling food and doing a few things like that. And really the best way to protect yourself in terms of living standards and wealth is to, a lot of it is, even you can read the economic textbook, but I think I've always found that reading the history books, finding what people did in previous generations when they went through these economic conditions and learning from what works and what doesn't.
It's all a cycle, isn't it, John? Let's just briefly finish up with gold and silver, because I know that you're the chief economist for As Good As Gold Australia, and it's great to have you on the program today. What I want to know is, just recently we had a bit of a pullback in the gold price. Do we care, or should people be having part of their wealth in what I consider, and everyone knows I'm a gold nerd, in real money?
Yes. So particularly when we see all the unprecedented actions by the central banks, when we see all this fiscal stimulus, I mean, you've got the central bank saying that there more stimulus is coming. The RBA said it yesterday, in terms of the Bank of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand said that more QE is happening by the end of the year. So did the Bank of England. Negative interest rates are looming on the horizon. And then obviously we're going to see more stimulus going forward from the US Federal Reserve. All of this points to, more inflationary pressure. Gold and silver, that definitely is the appropriate hedge in terms of how to protect your wealth. I wouldn't be necessarily concerned about short-term fluctuations, because the fluctuations, a lot of people don't actually understand where the price comes from. I mean, it comes from the LBMA in London and the over-the-counter market, as well as with the COMEX in New York. And we're starting to see pressure building in terms of that price mechanism, because there is a shortage of gold and silver, physical gold and silver going around the world. So I expect the demand for physical gold and silver to increase going forward because of all the central bank action, and we will see some very explosive action in the price of gold and silver going forward.
Yeah, and I don't think many people understand that, the ETFs, that's paper. If you were to liquidate the ETF market and say, give me the physical, there's not enough physical gold out there at the moment. So it's like a run on the banks. If you had a run on gold, I don't know what the price would be, but it would be pretty interesting. And I'm sure the folks at As Good As Gold Australia understand that, but it is, they also understand there is not enough to go around if everybody wanted to so-called liquidate their position and go into physical.
Absolutely.
John Adams, thank you so much for having a chat with us today. I would love to chat with you again towards the end of the year and see where we're at, because we live in interesting times, as they say.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.